step one, you say we need to talk. He walks, you say sit down, it's just a talk. He smiles politely back at you, you stare politely right on through. Some sort of window to your right, he goes left and you stay right. Between the lines of fear and blame, you begin to wonder why you came. Where did I go wrong? I lost a friend somewhere along in bitterness, and I have stayed up.
Good afternoon. We are at KPCA LP in Petaluma, California, and I would like to welcome you to our new radio show called Food is Energy. My name is Ray Cooper, and I'll be your host. And our show is new, and as it develops, I hope to bring you a variety of guests, people from all walks of life with a story to tell, athletes, nutritional experts, doctors, activists, scientists, just to name a few. And we're going to cover health and fitness and food and environmental issues. And also there's an ethical component to what we eat. So we're not going to leave that out. That's a big factor also. We've got a great show planned. Not one, but two special guests are here. One's in studio. One guest, Dr. Will Tuttle, will be calling in later. Dr. Tuttle is internationally known for his 2005 book, The World Peace Diet. And Dr. Tuttle and his wife, Madeline, have been traveling the world for several years advocating for veganism. My in-studio guest today is Jack Gescheidt. Jack's primary focus has been on trees, both in business and as an environmentalist. He's a nature photographer and an advocate of plant-based diets. Please welcome Jack Gescheidt.
Thank you, Ray. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. So I've got a list of questions, and I know Jack pretty well. So, there's a lot of things I don't know about you, but we've become pretty close with this meeting that I have in town called Veg Curious. Jack's been supportive of that, and I thank you for that. My list of questions is, you don't know Jack, but you will. So that's my title to this little segment.
Jack doesn't know Jack, but he's getting to know him over time.
All right, so here we go. Jack, tell us a little bit about yourself. And I know you're from New York, but what brought you to California? And you can start with the New York part, but I'm kind of anxious to figure out how you got out here.
A variety of factors all coalesced in 1996. That's when I ended up moving from, I was living in Manhattan at the time, living there 12 years as an adult, 35 years total in New York City, the city and the suburbs. And in a nutshell, it was just time for me to get away from the umbilical cord of home, but also an urban center, the city. It's a spectacular place, and I now recommend everybody, oh my God, you've got to go to Manhattan. Everybody should visit it, at least. But I'd lived there many too many years and really longed for nature and something different. And then as fate would have it for me, of course, I fell in love on a photo job with a woman in San Francisco in 1996 and decided, perfect timing, let's get out of Dodge.
Wow. So it was romance.
That's the hook in my life much of the time. Not always. And certainly when I was younger, it was more so. Yeah.
Well, you sure knew what to do when it was time to do it. Well, that's great. Part of me wants to kind of just get a feel for what it was like to grow up in Manhattan. I mean, those were some really cool days as opposed to now where it's kind of overrun, would you say? I mean, do you go back?
I went back a lot to begin with. I haven't been back as recently in the last couple of years. I had clients there and was going back for jobs, and I had family. Both my parents were alive, still living there at the time. So lots of reason to go back. And I love going back. I mean, it's a great place to visit.
Mm-hmm.
But not so much anymore. Yeah.
Let me just throw one thing out. What do you like most about Manhattan? I mean, is there something like a restaurant or anything, you know?
That's such an easy question for me to answer. What do you miss about New York the most? What's your favorite thing? Simple. The people.
The people.
The people. They're amazing. They're from everywhere. I moved to San Francisco, which for California is also, you know, a very diverse city, you know, for California. And New York, people come from everywhere because it's, you know, arguably one of the world's great cultural, ethnic, yeah, political, entertainment, business capitals. So people come from all over the place. And you have this incredible mix of cultures. And it's, I think Studs Terkel said, he called it not a melting pot, but a stew.
A stew.
Chunks of all these different kinds of people living side by side and you know, living well enough along, getting along pretty well. It's impressive.
I think one of the differences between Manhattan or New York and San Francisco is that they really give it to you straight there in Manhattan. They don't mess around.
You got a problem with that, buddy?
Are you talking to me? So I love that kind of stuff. Okay. So why don't we... I'm going to ask you another weird question. Why not? I mean, this is still early. We're not pressed for time right now, so...
No, but we should still hurry. We should hurry. Get it done quickly.
Well, you got to talk fast if you're in New York. You got to be a fast talker. All right. Okay, weird question number one. What three musical artists absolutely have to be on your iPod? That's going to tell me a lot about you, Jack.
For me? Wow.
Or do you have an iPod?
An iPod. You're so quaint. I think that's an Amish device that they started years ago, and now it's called a phone.
I got one that's steam-powered. Okay. So what do you got for me?
Gosh.
You got to think of it quick.
Yeah, well, Philip Glass is one.
Philip Glass? Now, is this a classical dude or what?
You don't know who Philip Glass is?
I don't know who it is.
Wow. Well, you've heard
I can't judge you now, Jack.
You've heard his soundtracks on 20 different films, and he's an avant-garde composer who's no longer so avant-garde. He's become the mainstream. I first became aware of him with an obscure documentary film, still one of my favorite of all time, called Koyaanisqatsi, which is a Hopi Indian word that means life out of balance. And it was a 90-minute documentary I saw world premiering at Radio City Music Hall. It seat 6,200 people. It was sold out on the first night of the New York Film Festival. My father got me tickets, a movie fan. I became a movie buff because of him. And I went to see this thing.
Oh, so he's got him Googled already.
With no actors and no dialogue. It's just visuals set to music, but brilliant cinematography set to music with, lo and behold, here I am, years later, an environmental theme about what we're doing to the earth, what we humans have done, Koyaanisqatsi. And it became a trilogy and then other spinoffs of it. But the first, I think, was really just a masterpiece, standalone film.
Okay, so Philip Glass, I've got a note. I even reached way over and got a pen to write that down because I actually don't know that. So this is going to be a great enlightening thing from this. My wife, Sue's in the studio, too. She doesn't have a microphone right now, but she's helping a lot. So she has already Googled it. Two more quick artists.
Second artist,
rock and roll.
Somebody. Second artist, to hell with your rules. I'm my own man. But, you know, lucky for you, the second artist you might have heard of, it's a group called The Beatles.
Okay.
And of course,
an obvious one.
Well, I grew up with them, but I just still listen to that music. And, you know, I like to imagine, although I'm, 58 now, that I'm not just the regular old guy. I'm a, you know, youngish feeling old guy.
Yeah.
There you go. There's the mind already, right? And I just, they did so much music. I mean, there's four talented guys working together over so many years. And whether you like hard rock or something so soft and melodic and sweet, they cover everything. So it's a combination of I grew up with the music, but also I fancy myself fairly objective, and so much of it still holds up.
Okay. Well, I would only say that they'd probably be a must on everybody's iPod. So it doesn't tell me much more about you, Jack.
No, it doesn't.
Toss me a bone here to say a non-vegan thing. What else you got?
God, I feel so on the spot. I'll regret not coming.
Who's Springsteen or somebody? You gotta.
No. That's New Jersey, man. Nah,
yeah, that's terrible.
No, I guess I would do. I would do Leonard Cohen.
I knew that. Another
you
guy.
You knew that?
I knew you would say that because that's another guy that I don't know.
Oh. Okay.
I've heard of him. I know he's big time, and he's written a lot of things. He's behind a lot of music, right?
Some people just spin and disgust at this, but I consider him a variant, a cousin to Bob Dylan, which is to say a brilliant lyricist, rather dark, but writes these incredible melodies with lyrics that make you think. So if you like the tune, then there's the lyric as well, another layer of meaning to them.
Okay. That's some more people for me to Google. I should look more into them. There's really something to Leonard Cohen, and thank you for that. And that's something you have in common with Kenny, a guy that's from New York that's going to be coming into this show, and he's a musician too.
And just a quip, I learned about Leonard Cohen not in New York, where you'd think I would and should have, but instead on the ecstatic dance floor in Sausalito in Marin County, California, where I was learning how to dance to get over my lifelong paralysis around dancing because I was thinking too much and talking too much and not just being in my body. They were playing these great songs like, who is that? Leonard Cohen. Who?
Yeah. So that was the
came later. Yeah.
Beginning of that journey. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, a big part of what you do is based around trees. And I'll have to say that since I've gotten to know you, I've learned a lot more about trees and focused on trees where I wasn't before. I liked them before, but I wasn't focused on them. And so I give you credit for that. I think it's a really important job. I think championing the cause of trees, I don't see a whole lot of people doing it. I think that it is happening, but I think you're the guy that comes out for trees that are going to be cut down. Even when I met you, the eucalyptus trees that no one seems to care about, you were really heading up that charge. So you're ahead of the game in my mind as far as trees. And I think it's tying in with something I was already into with the plant-based thing. But just to really get back into the trees, what did cause you to focus on trees in the first place?
Again, it goes back to me, to childhood, to, you know, the obvious metaphor, to my roots. I grew up in New York City, but I did that because my father was a New York City guy. Grew up in Manhattan himself, in Brooklyn, never happier than when bunkered in his Manhattan apartment, you know, a room not much bigger than the studio we're in here, you know, with the radiator cranked. In the winter, radiator cranked in the summer, clanging, and then in the hot summer, you know, 90 degrees, 90% humidity, the weather we don't have here in California, draw the shades, crank the air conditioner, and you're happy, and you just stay in your little cave. Nary a tree in sight. But my mother, the woman my father married, also from Brooklyn, was a tree lover, the first person I knew who talked to trees. So she pushed hard and got our family. When I was 1969, we moved permanently out of New York City up to the countryside in Westchester County. And before then, she pushed to get us country houses. So I really grew up, back to answering your question, contrast bathing between what it feels like to be in a very dense urban environment, New York City in the 1960s, compared to upstate New York, then just 90 minutes away, 2 hours drive away, was completely different. It's more developed, but it's just a completely different feel, with woods and streams and crayfish and crows and plant life, and just how the profound difference, how I felt between those two environments.
Mm-hmm. So the contrast, where your dad would just kind of show you maybe an area, a direction you didn't want to go, and that was pretty stark. And then your mom was opening the door for the nature.
Absolutely. She planted trees and got, you know, we were helping her with my mother, God bless her, with these worker hands, would take a big crowbar and pull these 200-pound boulders out of the earth and have me and my, you know, teenage then's brother help her get this stuff and build her rock garden and plant trees and just make our little quarter-acre property with a stream out the back, but then hundreds of acres of wood behind that, our sanctuary. And we could go, compared to New York City, it was safer back then, but we could just run off leash. We disappeared into the woods with our neighbors. We had a wonderful family, the Silvestris next door, with four kids and other neighbors down the street, and we would just off leash. Kids were free to run. And many more people, when I talk to people who are my age, you know, 50 and older, say, yeah, there was less fear, and there were fewer incidents. And I don't know that it's gotten less safe, but the perception is it's less safe now, whether that's in an urban environment or certainly in the woods, something bad will happen to you out there. And I think it's kind of one of my core beliefs, is why we're in the mess we're in environmentally, because we're feeling more and living more divorced from the natural world.
Yeah. So we have your mom to credit for a lot of the good things that are going to happen and that have already happened with your work for trees.
Indeed.
I think that's, and then did your dad ever really come around on the tree thing, and or was he just holding out?
You know, being in California now for over 20 years, I've done the emotional growth workshops you're supposed to allow you to stay in the state. And I've learned, I mean, both of my parents gave me great gifts, different gifts. My father, a tremendous passion for his work and dedication to, did I not mention that both of my parents were professional photographers?
Oh, I didn't know that.
All their lives. So people say, of course the apple doesn't fall, well, far from the apple tree. But I was 26, 27 before I kind of shifted. I mean, I knew how to take pictures. I grew up with a darkroom, but it wasn't until later that became my profession. And then the challenge became, what's my unique expression? Like growing up in a family of firefighters or cops. Yeah, of course you're going to be a cop, but you know, like what division and what are you going to do? And how's it going to be uniquely yours? Can it be uniquely yours?
Right.
So that was combining my father's passion for photography with the gift of my mother's passion for nature, which was passed to me.
That's the big spin, Jack, the nudeness that you have brought into this whole thing.
I'm sorry? What are you talking about?
The nudity.
What
and,
nudity?
And that's we could do a whole show on that too. Actually,
apparently you want to.
Well, I challenge you on it a little bit, but because this is my question, and again we'll just kind of skip over some of the stuff. But you do photograph people in the nude. They hire you to do nature photographs of them in the nude around mostly these wonderful mother trees, the huge trees. So it's the backdrop is trees, and so. You know, I guess the obvious question would be, how did the nudity come into it? But my thing is like, why do they do that? I mean, what's, you know, and it's not a sexual thing. I know that. I mean, it's like people aren't, it's not a, like a pornography thing, but.
You shouldn't knock sex, right? Don't knock
no,
sex.
No, but the thing we is, though, here's my challenge to you, is that I think people are getting turned on somewhat. No, it could be just a turn on that they're in nature, that kind of turn on, because they're nude. They have to be nude is the whole thing. Because you could just do it when they're not nude, okay? So that is my basic question to you. How did the nudity come in, and what is the appeal of the nudity for the people? Could they do it not nude? That's my question. Could you do the same thing and accomplish the same thing? There you go.
It's a fun show, isn't it? You could do an hour on this topic. I mean, it's...
I know.
Because this culture, in my humble opinion, has tremendous shame and conflict and, let's say, issues around nudity. Mm-hmm. Not sexuality now, just nudity. But, of course, those are inextricably linked in our American culture. The more you try to suppress sexuality, then it rears its head in the form of pornography, which is what arguably half the business on the internet these days.
Right.
But staying to nudity... these pictures would be very, very different. By the way, we're talking about, if that's not clear to the listeners, like, what the hell are they talking about? My photographs are collectively called the Tree Spirit Project. And
okay.
It's the, I will say, if I can with a straight face, it sounds funny to me when I say it out loud, the world's largest collection of naked tree-hugging photographs, which is to say people in relationship with trees, among trees, playing, climbing, lying on the ground, however, but the uniqueness of the collection, and I say that as a, you know, critical New York City-born photographer, is that the emphasis is always on the trees and the relationship between the person and the trees. It's not about the body or look at me or here I am. I mean, generally, over the hundreds of images I've made, and to your question about why do they have to be naked, there's an intimacy and an immediacy and a purity to images with people who are naked. It's why the classical artists worked with nudes.
How about a vulnerability? Is that well, I would think that's a good thing. I mean, they're exposing and taking away that protection.
So it's two things. People themselves feel vulnerable when they're naked, especially, again, I emphasize in our culture where we're taught to always be clothed, with rare exception. And then the other is, in the photograph, when you look at them as a viewer, a person who's naked clearly can do no harm to that tree. If it's a guy with boots on and plaid shirt and jeans, like, what's he doing up there? And is he, you know, breaking branches or ripping off the bark?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just such a different feel. And I used to be a portrait photographer before I began with this specialty, this art project, Tree Spirit. And I always was drawn to trees. If I was doing a wedding, you know, as a kid, it would be, you know, let's go under that lovely tree there in the shade. And I mean, this is what I want to keep returning to, is why I speak about any of this. When people are under and around, beneath, even just looking at trees through their windows, we feel better. People feel calmer. Why?
Right.
That's rhetorical, but and why? What's going on there with trees?
That is my exact, that's a great entree to another thing we could do probably five or six shows on, but let's hit a few high points here. What is great about trees? I mean, I know a lot of things that are great about trees, but I want to hear it from you. Just throw out a few things that, you know,
sure.
Trees just do so much and people don't really give them credit or focus on it. So what do you say?
So I've always loved trees. I've always been drawn to trees. But doing this project and sort of deciding to become a lightning rod or a galvanizing rod, an attractor to this issue, I mean, as with anything in nature, I suppose as with anything in life, the more you pay attention to it, the more you look at it, the more you see and the more you learn and you see the interconnectedness, whether you're an entomologist who loves ants or a biologist who loves life in the ocean. For me, it's trees and forests. I've always felt at home there, so that's where it began. But we could easily do an hour show. And I wouldn't even be the best person necessarily to do it. I convey my passion, and I'm, you know, I have some knowledge, but there are botanists who really know a lot more about trees. But to do a short list for you if you'd like.
Let's do a couple things that people don't know, some great things. I mean, there's obvious things of shade and protection and beauty. Well, give us a couple more.
I do want to start with the big ones because they're colossally important these days rather than the obscure ones no one knows about. So oxygen production, producing about, with plants and shrubs, the terrestrial plant life, they produce about half of this planet's oxygen.
Okay.
So kind of something important you might think.
Yeah.
And then specifically now, this is where I kind of shifted into more political activist gear. And as should be and must be discussed increasingly these days, now more than ever, carbon sequestration, pulling excess carbon out of the atmosphere that we're spewing, we humans, into the air at an alarming rate. Assuming you believe in facts and science.
Right.
And are willing to look at the colossal, overwhelming consensus of the world's climate scientists. Roughly the numbers, 97% of them are in consensus. Mm-hmm. You can pick apart and always find an exception, but the consensus overwhelmingly for decades now, since before Al Gore, you know, became the public sage with this, and to this day, trees are sequestering carbon, pulling the excess carbon out of the air. And if you don't do that, we will continue on this just horrific, unnecessary path of global warming, of warming the climate and fouling our own environment. We've known this forever, but it's come to an alarming, accelerated rate of late.
Yeah.
And if we don't do anything about it, it's just the greatest unnecessary calamity. We already have solutions to it as well, which we may get to.
Yeah, and I think that's a good segue because we've got our Dr. Will Tuttle's going to come in about 2 minutes or so, or maybe 3 minutes. So wow. A good way to do an entree to that is people might not know what they're doing or how to relate to the trees being deforested or that they're making an impact on the trees. Like, they're not cutting the trees down themselves. So how can they be a part of the solution, or how are they being part of the problem? And I think that what that boils down to is what we eat. So when they're talking about a lot of the, in South America especially too, they're eating a lot of meat. They're very proud of their meat down there. Obviously America too, but you know, all over the world. But deforestation for pasture land, that's pretty big. And so if you're eating meat, you may be contributing to that, not knowing.
Well, it's how I came to do what I do, which is to make photographs, not just for beauty's sake, which is wonderful, and I continue to do it for that reason, but also as an environmentalist, to raise awareness about the crucial role, the critical role that trees and forests globally play in our lives. And that's both what we're talking about now, the global issue of pollution and carbon pollution, GHGs, greenhouse gases, as they're known these days, but also personally, what trees can do for us. To enrich our lives and to calm us so that we individually have some control over our state of being. And then from there, make wiser choices rather than being frantic and hurried, you know. And I should know, I came from New York where everything is at such a breakneck pace, but to calm down and get focused. And then as you're alluding to, I would say the single greatest tool that each of us as an individual can use to address this global threatening issue is our forks.
Exactly.
What we eat. And I didn't know that. That's where we're going to speak to this wonderful new guest, Dr. Will Tuttle, coming in here. But I met him because I saw a documentary trailer, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
For a film, 2004, I think, Cowspiracy.
Came out in 2012, I believe.
Oh, 2014. There it is. Yeah. 4 years ago. Yes, thank you. Right. I lost 10 years there. You're saying you're starting to go.
And, somewhere in there.
And anyway, that film, it's really, I'd love to do a show, just a separate discussion about how each of us, and of course, my personal tale of how I came to make the connection between cutting down trees, deforestation, pollution of the earth, and then our consumption of cattle, specifically the largest animal. It's also cows, pigs, chickens. But what we do, cutting down valuable, crucial, indispensable, irreplaceable rainforest to raise beef. And even if you like meat or think you need to eat some or whatever, certainly not at the catastrophic rate we're consuming it, and then spreading it to other places that haven't needed meat to be healthy, certainly not.
Right.
Other parts of the globe, and it's for profit. It's so simple. It's just for profit.
Well, it's for profit for one faction, whereas if you leave the forest there, there's habitat. There's people making, they live off of the products of the forest that doesn't cut the forest down. Mm-hmm. Pharmaceuticals, which I'm not really a fan of, but a lot of the pharmaceuticals originate from the forest. There's a lot of products there that come from a forest that only come from forests that aren't there. You know, insects, beneficial animals, soil retention, and then there's carbon sequestering in the soil too, right? Isn't mm-hmm. that part of trees?
Of course, of
yeah.
course.
So that's yeah.
The rainforests of this world have been called nature's pharmacy. We extract so many different chemicals and compounds, and whether they're used with a lot of refinement or not from large companies is another issue. But I think the statistic is like 1 or 2% of the compounds in forests is our estimate of what was extracted, which means that 98% of this incredible pharmacy to help all of humanity will be destroyed before we've even plumbed its secrets.
Right. Here's a quote from the book Drawdown, which I think adds to what you're saying. When you add up the impact of carbon sequestering and storage, forest protection and tropical and temperate forest restoration together are the most powerful solutions available to address global warming. Mm-hmm. And that's right out of this book, Drawdown, which is a great book. The chapter on land use, I think, really speaks to the tree issue, and it ties in with a lot of different things. So we're going to get a call, I think, at any moment from Dr. Will Tuttle. And
can I just say how I came to know Will, by the way?
Yes, Dr. go ahead, Tuttle? Please.
So I hosted the screening for Cowspiracy before I'd seen the movie. It wasn't playing commercially, and there's a company called Tug.com where you can host a screening, which I did in Sausalito, invited people. And then this guy called me up out of the blue and said, "Hi, I'm Dr. Will Tuttle, 25-year vegan activist. I'd love to come and do a Q&A for you if you'd like." To which I was like, who is this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And, lo and behold, now 4 years later, here he's going to be on the radio, and I've met him several times since, and he's an amazing advocate. And the inspiration to me, I may tell him live here, is just he's so non-judgmental about it.
Yeah.
Which is not back to my beloved New York. Mm-hmm. The culture I came from was a culture of criticism, which is to make you better and have the best in the world. You criticize the stuff out of everything. So Will is just endlessly patient, and he's been an advocate for eating more plants and no animals, and for many, many reasons, for so many years, and yet he's never shrill or angry about it. So for me, that's an incredible life lesson to attempt to emulate as best I'm able.
Yeah, I think that the movement is filled with a lot of people that are passionate/angry, and it has a repelling effect against people that might be interested, So anyway.
That's been my experience. I had a first vegan I knew. I didn't even know what that word meant. I thought it was someone, from the planet Vega.
Yeah.
Although she didn't act like it. She was a New Yorker. But anyway, she was on my case. You asked me not to be profane, right? To be
right.
Playful. But anyway, watch my language. But she was like, "Do you know what's in your bagel there and that cream cheese? That's disgusting. It comes from a cow that was treated with hormones." But it's like, go F yourself, my dear friend. And yet, of course, now, years later, it's like she was, of course, right. It's just that approach of telling me how wrong I was wasn't helping.
Okay, so it looks like Dr. Tuttle is coming in. And we're going to take that call right now. Hello, Dr. Tuttle.
Yes. Hi, Ray.
Hi, Dr. Tuttle.
Hey, Will. Jack here.
Hey, hi, Jack. Great.
Don't say that at an airport.
So, what can we talk about?
Well, we've been talking about trees and the movie Cowspiracy, actually, and Jack was telling the story about how you contacted him out of the blue, and I think Jack wasn't even vegan then. And he was really impressed with that and just your easygoing attitude, I guess. And he's from New York, and he's had some experiences before he was vegan with people that were kind of putting him off a little bit because they were they were passionate about it. But and I know you're passionate, but you're very steady in your approach and steadfast, I guess, is a good way to look at that. And I picked up on that, and I think a lot of other people, Jack too now, I think. And Jack, you've been vegan for a while, a couple years or something, 3 years.
Yeah, and it was actually an ex-girlfriend who sort of hastened that acceleration in that direction, pushing on me, making me deal with it. Not in a nasty way, but just not letting me run and hide from it anymore, which is what I did, I think what many people do. I kind of knew, but didn't really want to know all of it, because then I'd have to deal with the consequences.
Yeah.
And of course, I just want to say this, assuming there are people out there who hear this and are not, converts, which I hope is the case. It doesn't have to be severe or traumatic. And ultimately, I feel so much better. And I don't mean just health-wise. I've been healthy on anything I eat. I'm blessed with that. But I'm just, my conscience is at rest. I don't feel sort of slightly guilty, pushing that away so I don't feel guilty.
Yeah, and that's a great thing, to, I think, for Dr. Tuttle to weigh in on, because this is what I've got written down here. The statement I'm making here is, it seems to me that the biggest driver of the vegan movement is ethics. It's by far the most powerful, and I think you'd agree with that, Dr. Tuttle.
Right. Yeah, I think if you, what Jack just said is really appropriate, and there's an underlying feeling, I think, with people when they hear about the idea that we really, no one needs to eat animal food. So there's no need for us to imprison animals, to impregnate them against their will, steal their babies, steal their purposes and their lives, and horribly abuse them for any nutritional reason. It's completely unnecessary, but people feel that they'll be giving something up. Usually what they're giving up is not only something familiar, the food that they have grown to identify with is the food they like, but also social relationships that are built around food. And so people don't want to give something up. And yet I know in my own research into any kind of authentic spirituality or even things that basically make people happy in the long run, it's always giving something up that gives to the greatest happiness. It's kind of like wearing shoes that are just a little too tight and hurting all the time, but you get used to it, you don't realize it, and then taking them off, it's like, wow, it feels so great to take these off. I can run and jump and dance now. But if someone had said, you know, you're take off those shoes, like, no, I'm not going to take those shoes off. I love my shoes. They're great, you know. Kind of identify. We don't realize how much misery, actually, we may be in. Very often it's not an acute misery. I mean, some people it really is acute, especially when the physical disease of eating animal foods like heart disease or cancer or erectile dysfunction or whatever it is, you know, kicks in. There's that kind of misery from eating animal foods. But a lot of times it's a low-level kind of unhappiness or feeling of dread or a feeling of trying to keep something away, trying to push something away, not really wanting to think about it, just eating. Because we're eating, right? We're eating cheese. We're eating misery. We're eating suffering. We're eating abuse and violence. But we have to pretend on some level that we are a good environmentalist, that we care about animals, that we love our earth. You know, we kind of have this pretense going, and there's this cognitive dissonance and emotional dissonance that's, you know, in the background. It's supported by every institution in our society. So everyone agrees with us. No one's going to criticize us. It's just those a few pesky vegans, you know, here and there. And we can easily ignore them because everybody else does as well.
Yeah.
It's really our true nature, I think, underlying that is our greatest ally that actually has us question that whole thing.
That's exactly you just walked right into my next point, because I think what's really, it's a lot more than a few pesky vegans right now, Dr. Tuttle, and you know that maybe when you first got started. And I want to get into this too, but you know, I've got down here as number two statement I was going to make is that, you know, the good news and what's really hopeful, makes me very optimistic, is I think we're all changing. The world is changing right now, and it all boils down to who we are inside and whatever that entails. And that makes me optimistic, because I see this from people that aren't vegan. You know, there's love of animals there. It's common for everyone. And I'm really hopeful with that. And let me throw this at you. You know, I could just say generally, what's your take on the progress of veganism in America over the last few years? And do you think we're lagging behind the rest of the world? You know, because the rest of the world is exploding, I think. But what are your thoughts there?
Well, I think in the United States is one of the leaders in many ways of the vegan movement. We have a lot of vegan meetup groups and authors and leading medical researchers. When I travel all over the world to China and speak on veganism, to Australia, New Zealand, Korea, Vietnam, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, you know, all these, whatever it is, South Africa, many places, it's pretty much everywhere. They're talking about John McDougall and talking about Neil Barnard and T. Colin Campbell, you know, in terms of the nutritional research. The United States is way out in front on showing, although there's other, you know, it's being backed up by many other researchers in China and Europe and many other places as well. But the United States culture really, as we all know, is still the preeminent culture in the world in terms of what everybody emulates. So the United States, when we get a strong movement here, it really goes everywhere. And I can say the vegan movement is huge in many other countries, especially in Asian countries where they has deeper roots. But I think the United States is great. I mean, it's growing. The problem here is that we have such an enormously powerful meat, dairy, egg, and pharmaceutical lobby, and they control the media so much that we have to do a lot of stuff like this. We have to kind of talk, find liberated spaces where we can talk about this stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like that.
That's really it, but it's good. I think it's growing.
It's almost like an underground movement in a way. I mean, here.
Yeah.
What's that phrase you had? Well, I loved it. I grew up knowing about the military-industrial complex, but you have a longer, more descriptive, and I would say more apropos.
Military-industrial, meat, medical, pharmaceutical, media, banking complex.
Oh, wow.
Would you say that again, just slowly so I can digest it, please? Seriously, it's wonderful.
Okay. The military-industrial, meat, medical, pharmaceutical, media, banking complex.
Wow.
So it sounds like a joke, but you listen to every word, and it's all pertinent.
I mean, you have to – a mouthful, to say the least.
Literally.
Yeah.
So many times, you know, because it's exactly what it is. I mean, the military-industrial complex is a big part of it, but you got to put in the animal agriculture. And then that's combined with the pharmaceutical medical complex, combined with the media complex, combined with the financial complex. And it all works together to maximize wealth in the hands of a few and keep people basically sick and not really very aware, disconnected, and at war. And that, again, serves a wealthy elite. But for us people, for future generations, for animals, for the trees and ecosystems, and we can't do it anymore. It's absolutely devastating. So we have to stop exploiting animals, and then we will be worthy of not being exploited ourselves.
So here's, you know, as I said earlier in the discussion before you joined us, I came to this discussion because I was embarrassed to say I was standing up on stages and saying I care about trees and I'm an environmentalist and we've got to do this, and I didn't make the connection. I didn't know until I saw Cowspiracy 4 years ago that the number one reason we cut down trees globally was to raise cattle for human consumption.
Right.
Fun, tasty, our habit, habitual, you can argue it's done for thousands of years, but on an industrialized scale, It's what's destroying, well, our own environment. It's even suicidal for people who own the large companies and profit from it. So it's not even just, you know, they against us and they're doing this to us. I mean, of course, that's to some extent. But when I hear this on radio shows, I listen to a lot of KPFA and it's, I mean, I get it, guys, but the empowering stuff is we, as opposed to me only pushing on a giant corporation to change its policies, which I try to do to the extent that one person can or groups can do. We have control over what we eat. It's an uplifting message, and then changing a tide of thought.
That's the only real thing we can do.
Right.
I don't want to get into the real negative stuff, but I want to talk about the grass-fed movement and this new level of deceit. I want to say, and I, you know, stop short of saying lies, but I don't want to fire people up, you know, and make them angry. But you know, to me, what's going on right now after 20 years of, you know, hard work by animal activists, the companies and the producers of animal products have reacted by creating these feel good, you know, terms and everything. And I've even heard a farmer who was talking about treatment of animals, you know, being treated really well, and then they have, quote, one bad day. And that just really struck me, you know, as it's a shining example of how much the truth can be openly ignored. And like you were talking about the media and how they're ignoring so much stuff, it's mind-boggling how no one realizes how much this statement negates any semblance of care or concern. I was going to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that it's predictable that the industry, which has a financial, huge financial investment of hundreds of billions of dollars in a system of massive confinement of literally billions of animals in the United States every year, and killing them and so forth. I mean, they're not going to just give that up.
Yeah, so but that's just a blatant.
You know, so it's predictable that there'll be the grass-fed, free-range kind of movement or health, some kind of healthy thing will emerge to try to assuage people's basically healthy sense of regret at paying people to abuse and kill animals unnecessarily. And so I think not only is the industry working hard to try to have everybody believe this, but the people themselves, many consumers, are working hard to believe what the industry says, because they also would like to, you know, they love it that they can walk into Whole Foods and see a sign on the wall that says, you know, this is caring meat for your, because you care for your family, because we care about our animals just like you care for your family. And yet all of the research that's done, you know, I've talked to many people who have, with organizations that send in undercover agents just to, you know, people, volunteers basically, who work in animal agriculture facilities, and over again, it's always the same story. Any animal facility, whether it's a large scale or a small scale, even the small scale backyard operations and small scale slaughterhouses, there's never a case where they don't find egregious abuse of animals and mistreatment of animals and neglect of animals, because we're stealing their purposes, we're reducing them to commodities, and whether you do it on a large scale or a small scale, it's still abusive, and it's the separation of the animals from their offspring at birth on any dairy, organic or not. They steal the baby from the mother, they impregnate the mother again on a rape rack, what's called by the industry, and they steal the baby and kill the baby and then eventually kill the mother just after 4 or 5 years when they would normally live 25. So we can see that on these operations, there's enormous abuse, and the fact that it's organic doesn't help. Very often there's even more suffering,
right,
because they can't use drugs to help relieve the suffering of the animals that are confined and abused and pushed to give more than they naturally would. So it's clearly a case of humans exploiting and dominating other beings. And always, whenever that happens, there's always, you know, attempts made to rationalize and justify these practices.
Yeah,
unnecessary and it's violent.
They're just getting more desperate. To make a statement, they have one bad day is just, I mean, I can't believe people don't call them on that. You know, they don't use it in advertising. I've heard farmers say it. But I want to ask you this too, and this is pretty amazing. I mean, thinking back, you know, when you got started 35 years ago, you know, and what it was like then. I mean, I'm just thinking, being you, and watching how far we've come, and you've got to be optimistic. I mean, we got a long ways to go, but just thinking about how it was when you were, you know, toiling away in the trenches, you know, relative obscurity, and coming up with this, and nobody's hearing it. I can't imagine how it was, and how it is now for you, Dr. Tuttle.
Well, that's nice of you to mention that. Yeah, because back, you know, I went vegan 38 years ago, and I remember at that point, back in the 80s, there was really very little awareness, and it was really, quite honestly, it was excruciatingly painful at many times, just because there was a complete unwillingness on the part of most people to even think or entertain the idea, because they didn't know anybody who was vegan. They never really heard about this. They didn't. Nowadays, you can at least, when you talk about veganism, someone will say, well, yeah, I have a friend who has a cousin who's got a son who's vegan or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody knows somebody. So it's, and there's restaurants, and so it's just, it's like anything. I have a saying, the more people who go vegan, the more people go vegan. You know, it's just
built
on momentum. And it's also, I think I want to say importantly, that what veganism is at its core is healing. It's love and kindness and caring and healing. And it's healing our relationship, really, not only with each other and the animals and nature, but really with ourselves. Because we're all wounded being raised in a society where from the time of little infants, we're forced, really without our permission, to eat these foods that we wouldn't choose to eat. They're really hideous when you think about it, and it's unnecessary. And so it's like we're just basically hijacked way onto a path of disease and disconnectedness and into a system based on domination and exploitation of resources of human beings and of the animals. And it's not in anybody's interest, really. So I think what veganism actually is a doorway of awakening that leads to many more doorways of even greater awakening for us as individuals and as a society. And it's essential that all of us understand this and begin to walk toward these doorways and through them and help our society create a future that's actually possible, that's beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Earth is so beautiful and so abundant. We could easily feed everyone here. And it's just this completely obsolete and outmoded thing that we've been born into. So the good news, like what you guys are doing, instead of fighting against this outmoded system and yelling at it, to just build something else, you know, build an alternative, eat great vegan food, and encourage other people to do the same thing, and we'll see more and more vegan restaurants and foods and so forth. And there's a place in the future for everyone.
Spread the love. Expand the love.
I mean, I think it, even personally, I think good things happen for people that are willing to, you know, venture out, have an open mind, and take a chance. It's been nothing but great for me. I mean, physically.
Right.
I've just opened my mind to other things like environment and Jack with the trees. I was totally ready for that, at where before I may not have picked up on it, you know. And Jack, I've given Jack credit for me seeing all these wonderful things about trees, and they actually give me a lot of joy, you know. And so it, in my life, it's helped me so much, and I do want to share it with people, and hopefully they'll have the same reaction or the manifestation of that in their lives. I really believe that it does manifest itself in your life in other ways.
Right. Yeah, that's true. It's a beautiful thing. It's like Jack said, love, you know, love actually for others and for ourselves creates an energy field, or creates a force field that brings greater happiness. You know, love is caring, you know, actually caring about ourselves and our loved ones and for the whole interconnected web of life here. And to the degree that we don't love and care about this web of life and others, we really create misery, not only for them, but for ourselves, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I just underlined, Will, that's why your thing, for lack of a better word, is the World Peace Diet.
Right.
For which you have a book and DVDs and a website advocating this, but it's spreading world peace by our individual actions and in our communities. We can take action and move in this direction to spread peace, which then ultimately ripples out through, if fewer people are eating these products that necessitate cruelty, we then help spread, or we reduce the amount of cruelty in the world just by what we eat.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because we're embodying peace in the way we're living. It's not just an act. It's an act of consumption. It's like, I'm not going to pay for this anymore, this violence, but also it's questioning all the underlying stories, the narratives of exclusion and so forth. And embracing, I think, our own inner wisdom of knowing that we're only here on this earth for a few years. Why don't we use our time here to grow and contribute to something positive and be loving in our lives for the short time that we have here? And I think that once we realize that, then we're part of the solution.
And I just want to raise one other point, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead, Jack.
So I grew up, you know, typical American, an American diet, and was healthy. I've always been healthy. I'm one of those people who kind of get away with eating less healthy foods. But I always had a lot of judgment about the few hunters I knew. Like, oh, my God, how can you be so cruel shooting beautiful Bambi in the forest? And now, you know, it's scary, you know, what you believe then and what I believe today. But I now look at I still have a few hunter friends, and I don't judge them. I really don't. I actually see what they do is less cruel than me going to then Walbaum's back in New York and buying something from the deli counter, because that animal was miserable from the day it was born. And then the issue back to what you talked about is the problem is we have now, whatever it is, 325 million Americans and billions of people on the planet, over 7 billion, and we just can't feed that many people by everybody going out with a bow and arrow or a gun and shooting their own deer. We have to industrialize. And as soon as you do that, then it comes back to the first thing I saw. I was like 12, 13 years old. It was a documentary. Maybe you know about this, Will. It was on PBS in black and white. It was the first time I ever saw a film. This is before videotape in the 70s. Footage of a slaughterhouse floor. Mm-hmm. And it was cows just walking along. And then I think it was a bolt gun to the head. And they get lifted up. And their guts cut up with a chainsaw. And their entrails come out. And I'm like, oh, my God, it was so friggin' traumatic. I'd never seen it. I was a boy. And I didn't know how to react. It was sort of what you talked about. It's why it came to mind. The trauma of seeing that. I can't forget that image, and I never did forget it, but I didn't know how to act on that. And no one talked about it. No one else did anything.
Right.
And it's in the industrialization, and I'm Jewish, by the way, so when I see that kind of assembly line of death, it brings me to tears that I was part of it. I was part of that because I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
You know, so just the awareness for me is what you say. Just educating what the truth is rather than an industry that spends millions of dollars in PR campaigns to hide the truth.
Yeah.
And the truth will set us free.
That's exactly what I was going to make this final comment, is that as we move forward, I can see there's going to be a lot more spreading of misinformation. Mm-hmm. Be ready for that. And as of three men that are sitting here right now that are of the group that is going around telling the truth and not being heard in a lot of cases. We're not on the major media or anything like that, but there's three of us here and we're all telling the truth. And I've always said on the show too, that if anybody has any opposing views, please come in, because I'm always looking for, you know, the best logic. I'm putting this logic out there. And if somebody has something they want to offer, and a lot of times they won't react. They will not come in here and give their side because they just want us to go away. They just want to ignore us. And there's a lot of things you have to ignore right now if you're going to eat meat. A huge amount of information that's running contrary to that logic. So,
that's really true. And I've traveled and given lectures for the last 30 years promoting veganism to, you know, thousands and thousands of lectures. And there's always typically a Q&A, and I've never yet had anyone make any comment or statement opposing this basic idea that we don't need to eat animals for food.
Absolutely.
Or other products, and that has any validity. I mean, there's really, you can't argue in favor of imprisoning and raping and enslaving other beings unnecessarily. There's no argument.
Yeah, right? I know. These guys, at this point now, they'll make a joke.
Right.
And the thing is, when you don't have an...
Make a joke.
It's laughable. Whatever. I mean, if you don't have an argument, you just make a joke and move on. That's all they can do at this point.
Right.
Well, I pride myself on playing a good devil's advocate. So the arguments, which you can get into, and eventually this we should really be inviting callers to do this kind of stuff, but it's...
Well,
this is what we've always done. Humans have always eaten animals. That's the first argument. It's quote-unquote natural.
Right.
Right. We can argue that we don't need to do that anymore, but that's the argument. The other is you need specifically the kind of protein that's in meat, which you the three of us now, and you, Will, my God, I'm just, you know, 30 years of vegan, and I know you. You're a powerhouse of energy and health. So you're one of many examples of vegans I've met along this path who are living proof, better than words, better than theories and papers for me, living proof. You're extremely healthy without eating meat. So that takes away that argument.
Right.
You know, and again, further discussion. I'm just hoping, I'm putting these things out there to know that I do know the arguments, and I invite people to, just from hearing this, wonder more and read a little bit more and learn a little bit more, to inquire more into it. Because that was, I needed to have it come at me many different directions over many years.
Or even let's have a discussion.
Right.
I'd love to see their logic. I mean, I'm not trying to say that I already know. I mean, I do believe in my mind that their logic doesn't stand the light of day. But bring it out there. If you're going to do something, call it what it is. Bring it out here. Let's look at it. You know, tell us what you're doing here. I mean, call it what it is. This one bad day thing is that negates everything right there, and you're basically floating that as everything else is great. One bad day.
Well, that's one argument. There are many arguments.
That you plug anything into that, it doesn't work. But we better let Dr. Tuttle go. I know you've got stuff to move on with your day. Thanks so much. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Jack, and thanks, Ray, for the great work you're doing, and thanks, everyone, for listening and being open to some ideas that maybe help positive change in our world.
What's your website again, Will?
Yeah, and it's worldpeacediet.com, and the book is The World Peace Diet. It's been translated into 16 languages now, and we're doing... I think we're very fortunate to be part of this movement, and we're happy to answer any questions people have or come to your area and present.
Well, thank you very much for your support, Dr. Tuttle.
Absolutely.
We'll get you on the show proper at some point in the future, and thank you.
Thank you, Will.
Right.
Have a great afternoon.
Thank you. You too. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, you're listening to KPCA. LP in Petaluma, California, and the show is Food is Energy, and we're getting close to the wrapping up, but we have Jack Gescheid in the studio with us, and we'll do a few closing thoughts with Jack. Jack's a tree advocate and a nature photographer. He has a group called the Tree Spirit Project, and why don't you tell us a little more about that, Jack?
Well, it's my art project that began kind of simply and organically with me just at a time in my life when I healed some old childhood wounds. It's a separate, longer story when we have more time, perhaps one day. But I just saw trees again for how beautiful and alive they were. I began to appreciate them again. And I've, as I said earlier in this show, felt attracted to them as a little kid running in the woods up in the country to get away from... all the concrete of New York City where I grew up. And then this later time in my life, I was in my early 40s, actually, and had kind of a, I don't know, emotional growth workshop induced from California spiritual awakening. How's that for a phrase? And I just was teary around trees in a way I hadn't been probably since I was a child. But now as an adult and with a skill set as a professional photographer, I brought a few friends, invited them to make these photographs with trees. And yes, it was absolutely and had to be tender and vulnerable and classic and free of the cultural cues that clothing provides. And there was a wonderful first set of pictures. It was actually two couples I went to a tree with, this giant old oak tree, older than America, actually. It was about 250, 300 years old. This is about a decade ago now, a little longer. And then people saw those pictures and says, oh, that's beautiful. I want to be in one of those.
Oh.
And I went back and did more. And I was just, on fire to just, I didn't know where I was going. I just knew I had to make these pictures.
You're very unique in that. Let me ask you another couple quick questions. We've only got a few minutes here. The term tree hugger, does that evoke emotions for you, or would you proudly call yourself a tree hugger? It's used as a derogatory term for some people, but I don't think it is. But what are your thoughts?
So here's how I'd answer that, the tree hugger thing. I grew up in New York, very rational minded, and you kind of learn to guard some of your stuff. They can be very open, wonderful people, but out in the streets of New York, hey, get out of my way, buddy, I'm in a rush. I don't got time for that crap. If I can say that word, rush, here on the radio. And so now, 22 years in California, I have friends that say, oh, no, Jack, wow. Or they don't even know me. They say, wow, Jack, you came from New York. Have you become one of those, granola-munching, crystal-healing, hemp-wearing, vegan, whatever that means.
Oh, yeah. Kale-eating.
Veggie burger, kale-eating guys, to which I say, oh, no, it's much worse than that.
It's much worse than that.
So I'm a unabashed tree hugger. I love trees. I love how they make me feel, which is, it's funny. I hear people talk about their gurus, here from the 1960s and 70s. There's lots of those folks in the Bay Area. And what they say is, the guru is my doorway to God. He opens my heart and makes me feel loving. And that's the way it is for me when I walk in the woods and I'm around trees. If I'm sitting in a studio like we are now and just look out the window and can see the green leaves of a tree. I've read enough to know kind of why, because we grew up with, we've evolved. We've never been on Earth without those things out there doing what they do for us. And there becomes an emotional and I would say a spiritual connection to them. And it just, I'm more open to it. And the more, I'm hoping other people hear this and just say, well, yeah, of course I love trees. Who doesn't love trees?
Well, I think they're not focusing on it. Like,
right.
And it's not just you. Like, you're just the one that focuses on it. We all have it.
Exactly.
And you've evoked it in me immediately. And after already going down the road of plant-based and everything, I picked up on it right away. I'm self-sufficient now. You sparked me, and I don't need you to maintain me anymore, which is great because I'm going to help other people too. But let me throw this at you. This is a good segue into this, but since you've become vegan, do you consider that like a conflict with not maybe necessarily yours, but a manly or macho image? Like, has that ever been a threat to you? Because you're kind of a manly guy. You're from New York, and you don't take any bull from anybody. And, what are your thoughts there? Have you ever thought that some guys, it's a threat to their manhood to be vegan or a tree hugger even?
Yes, that's all very true. And I've had my own, lifelong struggle with how masculine to be, how feminine to be, what does it mean to be a man? If I drop my voice down here and sound like father, oh, he's very masculine. It's like, you gotta be freaking kidding me. If I talk like this, I'm not a man. And yet, those are the cultural things we learn. So, I've had many teachers and some of them way out there from where I grew up in New York. And one of them said to me, I'll never forget it. I was talking about my cousin and a fight we're having and I was getting upset and clearly, the edge of tears. And he said to me something, it was very personal, it's not universal, but for me it was a big one. It was, Jack, your vulnerability is your strength.
Yeah.
Your vulnerability and your strength. And I'm still kind of digging into how deep and profound that is and to what extent it's true and to what depths it goes.
Right.
Because all I do is, I can immediately, as I say this, I'm thinking of all the movies where somebody's crying and he's made fun of for being,
right,
a sissy and weak.
Yeah.
And I have learned for me, when I speak the truth, my personal truth, that's all I can speak to, not a universal truth, but my truth, it can often touch other people, mm-hmm, or lead them to their own truth. We may overlap in some of our beliefs and thoughts and sentiments, sometimes not. Although ultimately, the most powerful connections I have with people are often nonverbal.
Yeah. Well, we got about 30 seconds. What I would say is, What you think of yourself is one thing, and what other people think of you is another. And I think that you're a very confident guy. And, you know, to me, I don't care. I don't put anything out there to make myself look more macho. I'm very confident with who I am. The vegan thing didn't even faze me a bit as far as my image to anyone. In fact, I like being different.
And I would say for me is part of me